Holy God, thank you for bringing us all together again. And especially thank you, Lord, for people who are willing to stretch and to grow. Lord, so many are content just to worship you, but you are never somebody who's content with just that. You are a person, you are the one who calls us to always be transformed, to always be stretched. Or as Eastern Orthodox said, we've been created in your image, but you call us to grow into Christ's likeness. And so, Lord, that's what we're seeking for today. And Lord, we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Before I really begin on Ted, I do need to be able to share my screen. But before we kind of move into the topic for today, I would like to just see if there's any questions from last week that anybody has regarding, Sarah, you did say the words came back, but were there any thoughts that you either thought more about, want to hear more about, anything like that?
I think you cover it so thoroughly. I don't have any questions. I'm okay. Just looking forward to learning more.
Okay. Well, let's begin. Today I'm going to try to move into how do we forgive. One of the things you've already noticed this, that part of my approach, I think a lot of times people in the Christian world, their approach tends to be, well, what does the Bible say about this topic? What does our theology teach about this topic? What you've already sort of gathered from me is that I talk about that periodically, but I'm an integrator. I tend to bring in ideas from a lot of different perspectives because I don't think human life can be reduced down to just theological perspectives or one particular theological perspective. But I'm really a big believer in, to really stretch and to grow, we need to have a theological foundation and a spiritual foundation, but we also need to be in dialogue with psychology and sociology and anthropology and biology and economics and mathematics and art and literature and music and things like that, because that is a large part of who we are. We aren't just theological. We aren't just spiritual, but we are all of those things together. And so today I am going to be using a little bit of scripture, but I'm going to really be delving you more and more into the world of psychology and psychological understanding, because I think that's something that often in typical Christian classes on forgiveness is often forgotten. Give me one second. I need to fix something real quick before we keep going. Sorry about that. You know, I come in thinking that I'm all ready, and then I forget to do something. And so I want to go back to a scripture I used before. You know, interestingly enough, you would think that the Bible is just filled with passages about forgiveness, but it's actually not. And interestingly enough, that the Old Testament is a little bit sparse in things about forgiveness. I don't want to say that it's not there, but it tends to be more God to us focused. You know, you have disobeyed me. You have pushed against me, you have done that, but I shall have mercy on you and I forgive you. Jesus is really the one, and then followed up, especially by Paul, Jesus is the one who really talks about forgiveness. And so in Luke's Sermon on the Plain, in Matthew, it's a Sermon on the Mount, but in Luke, it's a Sermon on the Plain. He talks about forgiving. He says, do not judge, and you will not be judged. Okay, right here, I want to really point out something that Luke is saying about the spiritual relationship with God, is that in a sense, the standards we hold for ourselves are the standards God holds for us. In other words, if we judge, then we open ourselves up to being judged. But if we don't judge, we open ourselves up to mercy. And he's not, this isn't transactional. You know, it's not like God sitting around going, well, Bob and Harriet, you know, they weren't forgiving towards each other the other day, so I'm not going to be forgiving towards them. Actually, it's a little bit different. It's more this sense of the more you transcend, the more you grow spiritually, the more you will have a spiritual life in yourself. And that becomes not only the standard that God treats you with, but that becomes the standard through which God begins to flow in and through you. And we talked about this with the Corrie ten Boom story I told last week. He then goes on, do not condemn and you not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. And this, by the way, is not just in terms of God, but if you are forgiving towards others, you will find others being forgiving towards you. If you don't judge others, you will find others will not be as inclined to judge you, although I have questions about whether how true that is. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. In other words, this abundance of mercy and grace. For the measure you will give will be the measure you will get back. There's a context, though, for this. This doesn't just show up as, okay, here's the law, here's the rule, obey. There's something bigger here. And it's Luke has Jesus saying this, but I say to you, listen, and this is the context. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, don't ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again, but love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. And I bring this out because then he goes on to say, talk about forgiveness. Forgiveness is part of this larger life that we are called to, which is rooted in love, which is rooted in doing good, which is rooted in blessing. It's rooted in generosity. It's rooted in compassion. He's talking about this abundant spiritual life that we can tap into where we really begin to experience grace all around. And the forgiving becomes part of that abundance. It's Corrie ten Boom even reaching back and saying, I can't forgive, but God, you can forgive through me. And then reaching out to the brutal guard. It's Corrie ten Boom saying, okay, humanly, I can't do this, but I am part of this larger, more abundant life that I want so much more for myself and for everyone else. And here is the struggle, and I'm going to be really blunt about that. I really believe evangelical Christianity has moved us away from that. It's gone more into an Old Testament eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's if you are my enemy, then I should be able to do anything I want to push you down. I need to protect myself. I need to secure myself. You know, we need to take this country back to a more Christian way of being. And yet, is this what they're asking for? Is this abundance of love and good and blessing, and not judging and not condemning and forgiving? But it's also, by the way, a life that progressive Christians are called to also, because it can become very easy. For example, for me, down the street from me, probably about a quarter of a mile, there's a guy down the street who has a big Confederate flag sign that says Heritage, not hate, which every time I drive by, I go, yes, a heritage of hate. of hating people and wanting to own them. But I have to, like, my wife and I've talked about that as we drive by, we have to like stop doing that. You know, we have to really kind of go, okay, there's somebody who lives there who is afraid, who, you know, he's flying the Confederate flag under the American flag, which is an irony. But you know, there's something about his life that feels threats everywhere and that's grasping hold of that. And so we've talked about that as driving by, and my daughters and I have talked about that. Okay, you know, let's not look at the Confederate flag as hate. Let's look at it as an indication of something going on in this person's life. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's at least an attempt to move into this more abundant way of living. Really quick, before I move on, I do want to see if anybody just has questions or comments or thoughts about any of that. Or reflections.
So,
go ahead, Ted. I'm sorry.
My comment would be there's nothing wrong with being discerning about what the Confederate flag stands for. But I think it's important to move on from that and be constructive, you know.
Well, that's, yeah. And that's kind of what I'm saying is,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, just to move forward in love. I mean, you can recognize the problems that are around you, but that doesn't mean you have to hate the sinner.
Well, that's exactly right. And the way I look at it is just because someone says something offensive doesn't mean I have to be offended. Just because someone condemns me and the values I have doesn't mean I have to be condemning towards them. I don't have to enter into that relationship. And that's an important thing. I can choose to come at it from a more spiritual perspective. As a result, you know, I will say in our family, the past 4 years have been really polarizing times, but we made the decision a long time ago that our relationship with everybody is going to be based on love, not on political perspectives, theological perspectives, which makes sense because, you know, I also have members of our family who are atheists and agnostics, and I still care about them and I still like getting together with them. And hopefully by the way I treat them, they don't see me like they did when I first went into ministry. I think I had a sister who I think pretty much thought, well, okay, Graham's now Jerry Falwell. And it's like, well, I'm not. But, you know, that was her thought, was all Christians are like Jerry Falwell. Therefore, Graham has become Jerry Falwell. And I had to kind of just say, I'm not going to buy into that narrative. Let me keep moving because I do have a lot of stuff to go over. I do like to make sure I'm not leaving people behind, but I also want to make sure that for this, we're moving forward because next week we're going to move in a different way. I've got three of our therapists from Samaritan coming in to talk about, to just kind of be a panel to talk about how they help people forgive. So what are the foundations of forgiving? Number one, forgiving always starts with our perspective on life. And that's something I'm going to actually ask you when you're done here with this class this morning. I want you to kind of sit down and try to figure out, what's my perspective on life? What's your basic theory? Is it eat or be eaten? I mean, I really do think a lot of Americans buy into social Darwinism, survival of the fittest, eat or be eaten. Others, you know, they may not buy into that, but they just have a perspective of life stinks and then you die. Although usually don't say it that way. They usually use more graphic language. Another is don't get mad, get even. You know, there's a lot of us in business who can be part of that, or just a lot of us in life or marriage. You know, marriages that fall apart. People often just spend their time constantly trying to get even with each other. Or another is we're helpless in the face of life's troubles. Or another is life is basically good with some bad in it. Are there other theories, and you can just pipe in, are there other theories of life that either you hold or that you know people have?
Well, you could add that, you know, the glass is half full or the glass is half empty.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest, if you look at life as the glass is half full, you're going to have probably have a harder time with forgiving people than if it's half empty. What are some others?
So I'm a big fan of the Presbyterian concept of utter depravity.
Tell me about that. And
which
why.
Is very polarizing, I know, but I find great comfort in knowing that, hey, you know, we've all got issues and we need God's grace. And so I need it, and the guy I'm mad at needs it. So get over yourself.
That's good. Any others?
Yeah, I was raised with sort of when life gets tough, the tough get going, something like that. I can't remember the.
Yeah, that was Robert Schuller's thing was tough times don't laugh, tough people do.
Yeah.
But also, yeah. Well, let me kind of keep going. Other foundations. Forgiving always starts with our perspective on events. How do we respond to life's events? Do we see the bad in events and look cynically at things happen to us? Do we feel powerless in the face of events around us? Do we tend to see the good around us, even in events, seeing what's possible? And again, how you see things is going to affect your ability to forgive. If you see only the bad in events and look cynically at all things that happen to us, it does make forgiving harder. If you tend to see good around you, even in events, and see what's possible, you're going to be more open to forgiving. Others is forgiving always starts with our perspective on people. How do we regard other people? Do we see people as basically bad till proven good? Do we see others as an impediment to what we're doing? I mean, I've seen this where, you know, actually I've seen it in people in business, in workplaces, where they constantly are looking out for people who they believe are sabotaging their work or undermining their work. I there are people like that. I will tell you where I see it as really destructive. I have known quite a few pastors who have a tendency to see everything, any kind of question somebody raises or a challenge, as saboteurs. And, you know, for me, it's been the pastors who come into a place and then, you know, make sure all the staff are fired so they can hire their own people, you know, because they're worried about saboteurs. And, you know, I do think there are saboteurs. There are people who do sabotage things in churches and elsewhere. But often I think we overly apply that. Rarely does someone really want to sabotage the work of another. Often what it is they don't understand what we're doing, or we're moving too quickly and it's overwhelming to them, even though it's not overwhelming to us. Or we haven't built up the trust relationship enough with them for them to really trust us. And, you know, or another is just, you know, I've come across this where you'll get, you know, in churches, this is probably not happening in Westminster, but in some really small churches where they've had a number of pastors come and go, the sabotage isn't trying to undermine what the pastor's doing. The sabotage is simply, you know, we never get to keep a pastor for longer than 3 or 4 years, and I know you're going to leave, so why should I give myself over to what you're going to do? I know for us, when I was at Calvin Church, we, over the time I was there, we did about $2.5 million of capital campaigns and expansions and property buys and things like that. But the very first one, where we were renovating the sanctuary, I remember when we were coming up on a vote, there were two members of the session who said, and at the time I was young, I was 37. And there was somebody who said, you know, well, in my father's church, they got a young pastor just like Graham, and he got them doing a capital campaign just like Graham's trying to do, which I wasn't. I actually didn't want to do a capital campaign. And then she said, and that pastor left right in the middle of it, and the church is still in debt. And, you know, it basically, I didn't see her as sabotaging me. I just saw her as, like, you know, she just didn't think I would stick at Calvin. She thought that it was just going to be a stepping stone for me to go elsewhere, and, you know, didn't expect me to stay for 22 years. And then I guess when she finally relaxed and thought I was going to stay forever, that's when I left. But, you know, that's a different story.
Graham?
Yeah, go ahead.
I've worked at a lot of churches, you know, as part of the crisis resolution team in the presbytery, that were struggling, and all the things you said about pastors and congregations, I saw that a lot of places. Yep. That is quite common. It's not a rarity. Would you agree?
No, it's not.
Yeah.
No, and actually, in some of those smaller churches, when they just had this series of pastors coming and going, there's a real lack of trust, not only with pastors, but with the presbytery or the, you know, judicatory body over. Because, like, why are we always getting these people who leave us? And again, they're not trying to sabotage, but they are feeling like they're at survival level, and they don't trust and they're afraid. And so, you know, when people don't trust and are afraid, they do things that aren't necessarily rational. Well, Dan, did you have more about that?
Well, as small churches are declining,
yeah,
they hang on to the past and aren't logical about the realities they face financially, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it's a very emotional situation.
Yeah. And the more they decline, the harder it is for them to embrace things that help them to grow, because they start developing, which I talked about last week, they just start developing a survival mindset.
Yep.
Wait, I don't know if I talked to you all about that last week or I talked to another group. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The big question when it comes to forgiving others is, do we have a perspective captured by pain and hurt? Do we have perspectives that sees the person and events from a variety of perspectives? Do we take into account their background, their upbringing, possible trauma, compassion? You know, for example, one of the things I've noticed, and this is especially true in adulthood, is the bullies from when I was in high school didn't realize it at the time, but most of them, their family life was just really bad. And interestingly enough, a number of the people who were kind of bullies at my school growing up have either died of drug overdoses or alcoholism, or have just lived lives with just a wake of pain in their rearview mirror. And, you know, for some of them, it took me a while to forgive them. But what really helped was as I began to see their lives falling apart. I used to say this to my daughters, you know, when you're in high school, bullies have a lot of power. But when you get out of college, nerds rule, geeks rule. And I said, so it's always important to strive to be a geek, because geeks rule in life. Bullies, you know, they fade. And
that could be so painful in high school.
It's awful. Well, and it affects your life. I mean, you know, I mean, for me, I know that there's a number that I've had conversations with afterwards, you know, that I didn't come out and say, like, I forgive you, but I did come out and say, I'm going to be forgiving to this person, even though this person doesn't know it. So at high school reunions and things, I'm going to talk to this person and see how this person is. And that's where I really kind of discovered, you know, how kind of difficult their lives are. And I will say, I did find out later, two of the kind of, I don't want to say dominant bullies, but dominant figures who could be dismissive. I found out later, both of them had been sexually abused by a person. I grew up in Swickley, or at least partly in Swickley. I grew up in Philadelphia in Swickley. They had been abused by a guy who was a public figure and used to take them out on camping trips. And, you know, one of the people committed suicide, and I think it was just something, and, you know, as a high schooler, I'm not going to realize that they're, you know, acting out of the fact that they got sexually abused by somebody, but, you know, and actually I found this out from another friend who did come to me to talk about the abuse on him. Years later, and actually helped me, you know, asked me to help him to, you know, get counseling for it and to, you know, kind of overcome his life from it. So I want to delve you into some basic psychology lessons. I first want to talk to you about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I don't know how many of you are aware of this. If you've taken basic psychology, typically this is a lesson. But Abraham Maslow was a research psychologist at Brandeis University. And in 1968, he came out with this idea of hierarchy of needs. And what I want you to do is I want you to cut off the part that says self-transcendence for now, because that wasn't originally part of his hierarchy of needs. Basically, what Abraham Maslow said is there's a hierarchy of needs that need to be taken care of before we can really move further up into growing and becoming, you know, what he at the time would say self-actualized self. He said that basically, if you don't take care of these needs, it's really impossible to, or it's not impossible, but it's really hard to move up and develop these other skills. So the basics are physiological: breathing, food, water, sex, sleep, homeostasis, excretion. You already know this. I think that with the pandemic and with COVID, it has moved, you know, once you get the virus, your whole life then becomes just about breathing. It's about, like, you know, sleeping. It's about trying to get your body back to homeostasis. And you know, it's the reason why, you know, Jesus and Christians have always focused so much on mission that takes care of physiological needs, because there's an awareness that you can't really grow spiritually if you're hungry. You can't really grow spiritually fully if you're homeless, if you don't have clean water, if you can't sleep, if you don't have, you know, if you're just, you know, basically living hand to mouth every day. It doesn't matter how brilliant, you know, preaching is. It you can't deal with people that way. You have to take care of that first. And a lot of Christian mission and a lot of Christian life is about that. If you have those needs met and they're really basic, eventually you can move into the level of safety where you've been to grow. And so, for example, babies are all about breathing, food, water, sex, not sex, but breathing, food, water, homeostasis, and especially messy excretions. That basically, as they grow, for a child to grow to be normal, they need to feel safe. And so there's a security of body and later on of employment. If any of you have been unemployed for a long period of time, you know that when you're unemployed, it's very difficult, because that becomes your obsession of resource, security of resources, of morality, of the family, of health and property. So I want you to think about this pandemic. And I also want you to think about really where America has gone over the past decade, you know, really beginning with 9/11, moving through all the school shootings and all sorts of shootings, you know, both the people who are getting shot and are victims of gun violence, but even those who are doing the gun violence are living at a safety level. You know, it's all about my security. How do I protect myself and my family and my property and my health and my morality? And you see it more and more, you know, kind of America against everyone. That in many ways, the pandemic especially, you know, the whole, you know, thing about freedom and wearing masks and things like that, you know, it's people who are kind of living at the level of safety, because that's what the culture has become in the pandemic. But if you're able to feel secure and safe, it moves you to a level of love and belonging. And I think all of you get this, where you begin to develop a sense of family and of friendship and of sexual intimacy and of life intimacy. And if you're able to get there, to grow into there, you're able to move up into a sense of self-esteem, that you have confidence and achievement and respect of others and respected by others. And Abraham Maslow originally said, you know, and the highest form of this is self-actualization, where you become an intact self, where you become aware of yourself in the world, and you become aware of how you can be an impact in the world and not, and you develop this sense of not only self-confidence, but this sense of, I can be better. I can grow to a place psychologically where I'm really healthy and I have healthy relationships. And Maslow said that ultimately life is about moving towards self-actualization. But if any of the other lower levels are impacted, it's very easy to slip back down. In the last years of his life, towards his near his death, he actually added another level. And interestingly enough, it was a level that he added as a result of his conversations with somebody I studied with at Duquesne, a guy named Adrian von Kahm. They were friends with each other, and von Kahm actually spent a semester up at Brandeis teaching Maslow's classes when Maslow went on sabbatical. But Adrian von Kahm constantly told him, you're missing another level, which is self-transcendence. It's not enough just to be psychologically mature and mentally mature and emotionally mature, but there's a transcendent level where now you're about others, where now you're about caring for others, where you're seeking a kind of intrinsic happiness and meaning and a real deeper sense of meaning and purpose, which comes with self-actualization, but really comes with a sense of transcendence, where my life isn't just about my own maturity, but it's about others. So why am I bringing all this up? Because the reality is, to forgive others, it requires you to move towards self-actualization and self-transcendence. That if you are immersed in safety and physiological needs, people will always seem like they are threats. That what happens is, as you grow spiritually, as you grow psychologically, as you grow in all these different areas, you begin to be able to let go of fear and anxiety and concerns about security and safety and protection and things like that, where you can begin to be rooted more in love and in confidence in my love, but you're moving towards that. And if you go back and you read the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Mount is a sermon that's all about, how do you reach self-actualization? How do you reach self-transcendence? And so this is the part of forgiveness where basically what I'm saying is, to forgive, you have to aspire towards that self-actualization and self-transcendence of saying, I want to grow to that point spiritually where I really can take account of others, where I'm really able to move out of myself, out of my lower levels, ways of thinking, and I can move into a sense of transcendence. So I'm going to stop here because I want to keep moving, but I want to see if anybody has thoughts or comments or anything else or questions before I move on.
You know, the assumption of a zero-sum game has come up a lot for me recently. I'm not sure why, but, you know, I'm looking at this hierarchy from that perspective too. It seems like there's a relationship there.
But the hierarchy is more based on win-win than zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Safety and security is more zero-sum game. You know, it's about me. I have to protect myself, you know, and this is political too. I have to protect myself from you. I think this is where I get so distressed about American politics. It's probably politics in general, but in European countries and all, there tends to be a larger role for moderates than in American life right now. But, you know, what you see right now is very little win-win. It's all about, how can I claim a victory for myself? And I really feel like our politicians, I don't think they're crooked. I don't think they're bad. I don't think they're corrupt. I do think that they're caught up in a zero-sum game where they feel like, if we cooperate with the other side, we will be kicked out of office. And my response is, that job can't be that great, because, like, all you do is get criticized. Like, who cares when you get kicked out of office? You know?
Well, but it's about power.
I know. I understand that. Yeah. I get that. And it tends to attract people who are into power.
Yep.
So the thing that comes to mind for me is that Christianity is all about grace and abundance. And it seems to be sorely lacking, both in public discourse, but even in, in discourse that presents itself as representing a Christian viewpoint.
Yes.
And I don't know how you can talk about the gospel or think of yourself as a follower of the gospel and abandon the idea of grace and abundance, because that's really
absolutely it's taught. And it is why people are walking away from Christianity. It's they know what the Sermon on the Mount says, And then they look at the way Christians act, at least the prominent Christians, you know, they see people like Jerry Falwell Jr., you know, kind of, they look at what people like him do, and they basically go, I don't want to be part of this. Christians aren't loving. Christians aren't compassionate. You know, my argument back is always, you're not looking, you're not seeing, you're only paying attention to what comes on the news. But, you know, but I'm also, when I say that, I'm sort of asking them to do deeper research that, you know, they're probably not going to do. I think it's very difficult. And I think as churches, we need to be mindful of how one thing I will say, you know, in all the work I do with helping churches turn around, one of the things I really encourage churches to do, and very few ever take me up on this, it's something I did at Calvin Church. Go and have conversations with people who've walked away from the church, and like even create focus groups of people who've walked away from the church. Ask them why, ask them what their problem is, and then see if you can adjust what you're doing in church to meet what they're grappling with. But, you know, that's a really threatening thing to do. You know, that threatens talking with people who walked away from the church and might even be angry and criticize us. It moves us down to that physiological and safety, you know, level, because we want to protect the church. So what we do is we say that people who are spiritual, but not, excuse me, not religious, well, they're lazy, or they're not very spiritual, or they're into woo-woo stuff. And but we don't actually ask the question, you know, kind of what's going on with them that we could change what we do to reach out. Other thoughts or questions before I move on? So I want to kind of move off the hierarchy of needs and move to another basic, I'm going to move you to a different kind of psychology. Abraham Maslow comes more out of the field of social psychology. I want to move you more into the field right now of what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy is based on behavior modification. A lot of more traditional psychology is based on the idea that you have kind of deeper motives, deeper traumas, deeper issues that we need to dig back into and resolve them to help change your behavior now and in the future. Cognitive behavioral doesn't do that as much. It actually looks at it in a different way. And I'm a believer in both. I don't choose one or the other. I think cognitive behavioral is really effective with some issues and not as effective with others. You know, that more deeper approach is more effective with other kinds of issues, but not necessarily things like anxiety and things like that. But in cognitive behavioral, they have an understanding of how the brain works. And I'm going to apply this to forgiving, but basically what they say is with any kind of behavior we have, it always starts with some kind of emotional button or trigger. You know, going back to a high school reunion and seeing the bully, you know, right, just right there, you see that person and it's, the person is well-dressed and looks successful. That can really be an emotional trigger. Automatically, once I have that emotional trigger, what happens, oh, there you go. That once that happens, I begin to have a thought or even an emotion in response. And once that happens, once I have a thought or an emotion towards someone, that starts me down the road towards having certain kinds of behaviors show up. That eventually, so there's an emotional trigger. And I'm just going to pick the bully. You can pick almost anything. You can pick food. You walk into the kitchen, there's cookies on the table. That's an emotional trigger. And your thought in response is, ooh, I want that cookie. And then it turns into action. I eat the cookie or I walk out of the kitchen or whatever. Because the thought may be, ooh, that cookie looks good. I'm going to have it. Or the thought can be, oh, I can't eat cookies. And so you're going to have an action in response to it. I'm either going to walk out, ask someone to put the cookies away, or I'm going to put the cookies away, or I'm going to eat them. Same thing with the bully, emotional button or triggers. I get a thought in response. Oh my gosh, that's so-and-so. And so-and-so looks successful. And if I go up and talk to that person, you know, that person may bully me again. So your action is, it may be, I'm going to avoid that person all night long. or I'm going to go up and talk to that person and overcome that person's bulliness, whatever. The action, if it's done enough, well, the action always results in some kind of consequences. The consequences can be, I'm not going to be talking to that person. The consequences can be, I've talked to that person and I've overcome their power with me, or I've talked to that person and that person just bullied me again and made fun of me. Or the action can be, I ate the cookie and now I want more. Or I walked away and now I've been successful at it. If you do particular thoughts, actions, and results long enough, they will eventually turn into habits. You know, for example, if you don't resist the cookie enough, eventually every time you walk in the kitchen and you see cookies, you're gonna just have a habit of just grab it. You don't even think about it. It just becomes a habit. The thing with forgiveness is the same thing. There's an emotional button or trigger that basically something happened to you. Somebody did something to you. And in response to that thing, you developed a certain way of thinking about that. That's the person who hurt me, or that person hurt me in the past. An action can also be what's called perseverating. Perseverating is I keep thinking about it over and over and over. That can actually become an action. The action can then become a consequence, which is the consequence of that action is I can't forgive that person for what that person did to me back then. I can't, Bob, I'm going to stick with what you also said, which is forgiving yourself. Something reminds me of something I did that really hurt somebody. And my thought in response is I'm a terrible person. Look what I did. I'm awful. And the action can be, I now have a perspective on myself where I now think of myself as just bad. And the results are, I start to think of myself as bad in other areas. And I develop a habit of just negative memes that constantly come in. Forgiving means jumping in somewhere in this train and cutting something off. Often what I think the best place to start is you have an emotional button or trigger and you change your thinking. So you've taken this class with me. Something happens that you have a hard time forgiving and you start moving into the habitual way of thinking. The thing you need to do is to stop and start thinking differently. And that's what I just tried to get you all to think about in the previous slides. So you've had this bully who's done awful things. My perspective is this person has power. This person is a bully. This person is awful. And it sets into line all of this. But what if I stop and, you know, I talk to the person or I talk to someone who knows them and said, what's happened with that person's life? And you find out that person was sexually abused. You find out that person came from a broken home. You find out that person had an alcoholic father or alcoholic mother who either was absent or not there. So now how do I change my thoughts and response? How do I be intentional about looking at this differently? And then it comes, okay, what action do I take based on that? And that action is, you know, do I change the way I think? And so now do I talk to that person in a different way? Or is the action, I'm now going to think about that person in a different way. Because that changes the results, and that has the tendency to change habits. By the way, this little cognitive behavioral thing, this is what people do in terms of overcoming anxiety. It's okay, you have a trigger that causes you to become anxious. How do you think about that trigger? And what our therapists do is they help them to explore other thoughts that lead to other actions that lead to other consequences. So it might be mindfulness, or it might be deep breathing act. You know, it's somebody who begins to feel anxious in a situation is trying to help them and say, you're not a slave to that situation and you don't have to be a victim. So how do we change your thinking so that, you know, you're not a victim? I will give you a simple trick, by the way. If you really like a good example is if you go shopping and you have a hard time not buying foods that are kind of a struggle for you. here's a cognitive behavioral way of dealing with it. The emotional trigger is you're in the aisle with the potato chips or the ice cream or whatever. And your thought is, do I want them? Do I not? Well, the action eventually is you grab a bag or you grab a pint or you grab a quart or you grab a gallon or whatever it is. So one way of disrupting this is go intentionally to that aisle, stand in front of the really tempting food and just start saying to the food, no, 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 I won't, I won't, I won't, I won't. That changing thought, that changing action, if you do that all the time while you're shopping, eventually you will stop going down that aisle or at least stop stopping in front of that place. So again, this is real basic psychology, but here's the thing, forgiving is an intentional act that's intentionally built. And it is built on responding to triggers in a different way by changing our thinking about those ways. So again, I'm going to stop here and see if anybody has comments or questions or thoughts about any of this. Because even though we're about to go out of time, I do want to real quickly move into just some ways of changing the thinking.
No, I think what you're saying for people that are not in the habit of forgiving, this is revelatory.
Yes.
I think for people that have, for whatever reason, done it for a while, it's kind of the basics.
It is. It is. But it also says that if you are forgiving in most areas of your life, but there's one area where you can't, think about this in terms of what's the trigger, what's your thought, and how do you look at changing your thinking?
Yeah, for me,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, for me, this applies directly to our work in Homewood, because you've got the black leaders of Homewood and the white guys from Westminster and other churches working to partner to transform the community. And there's always tension. But it always helps to understand the trauma that Black folks have lived in for 400 years. And of course, all that's become far better known in the last year. Because
to some people, I think to people at large, but not to everyone. I agree though, because have that mindset of, hey, the Vietnamese came over here in the 70s and they pulled themselves up. Why can't Blacks do that themselves? And realize, well, you know what? What I just said, this chain of events, when you, as Dan, you bring up, you've had 400 years of this. It's the whole culture now is struggling to change the thinking because they've had 400 years of saying, I can't trust white people.
Yeah. Well, but they've got really good evidence for that belief.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, and, you know, and we kind of go, well, look, every other immigrant came in and, you know, were able to overcome it. It's like, and those other immigrants, nobody went and grabbed them and then basically brought them over to be slaves and beat them. And then basically after they were freed, created Jim Crow laws or redlining or any of those kinds of things. I mean, this is stuff that Ralph and Tony Norman and the two other doctors talked to you all about, it's changing the thinking. Well, let me keep going because I would rather not have to devote next week to this, but give me a few more minutes and I think I can zip through these next few slides because I really want to get to the last one. So are there perspectives that can lead to forgiveness, changes in thought? Can we look beyond our pain to see the person and the act from their perspective? Do we recognize that they may be acting out of their own pain? By the way, going back to what I said in the very beginning of 3 weeks ago, forgiving isn't forgetting, forgiving isn't condoning, forgiving isn't remaining being a victim, forgiving is not, those capture it, but you still can understand. Do we recognize that they have mental or emotional problems that lead to their acts? Do we recognize that they have acted out of base fears and concerns? Do we see that people are captivated by pain and need to be forgiven? They don't know what they're doing. Can we look beyond our pain to see the person, the act, and ourselves from a long-term perspective? Forgiveness helps us and others and all of life long term. It releases us from resentment and bitterness. It releases others from their pain, and it creates the context for healing and possibility. Think about Germany after World War II versus after World War I. After World War I, we could not forgive Germany. I'm talking about the Allies, couldn't forgive Germany. And they brought down upon Germany retribution, which eventually allowed for the rise of Hitler. After World War II, the Allies were forgiving. The Allies reconstructed. The Allies helped. And now Germany and also Japan are two of our strongest allies. And the difference is, because the difference between the two is, after World War I, we acted with retribution. After World War II, we acted with forgiveness and reconstruction. And the difference was, it led us to a way of living together, which improved the world. Can we look beyond our pain to see the person, the act, and ourselves from God's perspective? Ultimately, true forgiveness comes from God, not ourselves. Forgiveness is an act of love that reconnects us with the source of love, which is God. And real forgiveness is ultimately something that's transcendent and self-transcendent that God does through us, not something that we do. I'm going to invite you to read 1 John 1 on your own, if you have the slides. But I want to kind of end here with just thoughts on how to forgive. And I'm going to ask you to take these and reflect on them. Real forgiveness begins when we change perspectives on the event and the person. When we change our perspective on past events, it's going to sound weird, but we actually change the past event. And what I mean by that is, the act is just the act, but when we change the perspective on the event and the person, it changes our interpretation of it. It changes the power it has over us, and it even changes what the meaning of that event was. And that change in perspective actually changed the history of it for us. And we do this by seeking God's perspective on life, on the event, and the other. We do it by trying to develop compassion for the perpetrator. You heard this in the film clip of both Bud Welch and also Michael Morrissey, or Morrison, whatever his name was. One was forgiving the father of the person who killed my daughter. The other was forgiving the one who murdered my wife, but also forgiving the people who put me in jail for 25 years for a crime I didn't commit. It's seeking long-term what's best for you and others. Real forgiveness happens when we prayerfully seek God to forgive through us. It happens when we decide to release ourselves from captivity to pain. And it happens by also our repenting for making pain stronger than God's love. And I'm going to stop here and see if anybody has questions, because for the first time in 3 weeks, I actually got through all my slides. So any thoughts or comments or questions before we end, or perspectives? Or what of all these lessons hit you today?
So Graham, I'm going to jump in and say thank you very much. I'm going to stop the recording right now and let people turn on their cameras if they wish.